CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with the author of the new book, Red Memory, The Afterlives of China's Cultural Revolution, Tanya Bronigan. And we go to a moment, August of 1966, Red August it's called, and the memories of a 13-year-old many decades later in her 60s and 70s about how she got caught up in events that she could not understand and still is haunted, cursed by the memories of what she saw between August of 66 and her birthday, December 26th, 1966. Her name is Yu Chengjiang. Tanya, Yu was 13 years old, and she's remembering now these many decades later. She was part of the rally. I believe the date is 3 a.m., August 18th. We were called to Tiananmen Square. Why? What happened that moment?
So this was the first of the mass rallies that Chairman Mao held for teenagers, for Red Guards, really giving his seal of approval to the Red Guard movement. Because, of course, the Cultural Revolution was not a grassroots uprising. Although the first Red Guard groups formed spontaneously, it was within a context where it was becoming clear that Mao wanted upheaval. And Mao, of course, was a figure that they revered as a god, really. And so Mao had summoned them. His aim was to turn to the masses, particularly young people, to wipe out political opposition to him within the party. But he really called upon these young people, and it was a great sort of grand ideological overhaul in which he said that the revolution had failed or fallen short, in a sense, that the people within the party were either actively working with people to try and turn it back or had simply become too complacent and had been seduced by power and so forth. And so he called upon young people to remake the world. And through these rallies, he put his seal of approval upon the Red Guards, but also through the words of the leaders there, they were encouraged to go out and destroy the four olds, as they put it, to smash the old world, to get rid of the old culture and ways of doing things, and to create this newer, ideologically purer world. And this involved not only destroying artworks or bourgeois property, but also turning on people themselves. Some of the most revered figures in China, from the very top leaders through thinkers and scholars and sports people, all lost their lives as a result.
A detail about what we understand Mao's idea here was to ignite the Cultural Revolution. That was the phrase that burned across China, soon introduced on the radio as well. And yet, Tanya gives us some details here that suggest that Mao was doing what other kings and emperors have done. He was purging those closest to him because he feared that his reversals and mistakes were going to lead to his loss of power. Nothing about communism here. It's everything about tyranny. 1958, the Great Leap Forward turned into mass starvation. Tanya reports perhaps as many as 45 million died. The party was extremely discouraged, and Mao saw that there were other voices in the party who challenged his decision-making. And then there was earlier in 1963, about socialist revolution. That was a precursor to the Cultural Revolution. The four olds, ideas, culture, customs, and habits are now part of the Cultural Revolution, turning teenagers loose for free on buses, for free on trains, to roam across the land and persecute people for no cause. They don't even know them. They rob their homes. There's a scene that Yu Chengjiang gives us. She's in a home, and her classmates are beating the couple who live there, and she sees two girls pocketing jade. What did she make of that, Tanya?
Well, she certainly concluded that in that case, those items, those treasures, were probably not being taken to the revolutionary cause, but perhaps were being taken by those girls for their own private use. But of course, like so many Red Guards at the time, she was also very zealous herself, in a sense. She had a very idealistic view. It's very hard for us to imagine, I think, how it must have been in that moment, growing up in a country where you were constantly told that the People's Republic was under threat, which of course was true in a sense. Chiang Kai-shek certainly was still hoping to come and reclaim the mainland at some point. You had a country that felt profoundly threatened, at the same time had been brought up with this ideal of revolutionary struggle and sacrifice. Their parents, in many cases, had sacrificed immensely to bring about the communist revolution. They've been brought up to worship Mao. So there is this very intense atmosphere, and these very young people, children really, who are being told that they should go out and destroy, that they should force people to become better communists, in a sense. And so you herself, while she was disturbed by some of the things she saw, she also genuinely believed that the Cultural Revolution was a cause that was right and was just. And her own hesitation in beating people, for example, she sometimes wondered if that was really her being perhaps too weak, not being pure enough, not really believing enough in the cause. It was a profoundly confusing and disorienting time for so many people. And as hard as it is for us to imagine what lay behind the horror, and of course, we know human nature being what it is, that people very often are capable of horrific acts that we might not have imagined. And people were driven by all sorts of reasons, be that personal hostility to some people, grudges or so forth. There also was a level of real belief that this was the right thing to do.
Her patrimony is apparently highly admired at this moment in time. I said that Tichy Bien, her father had been a banker, therefore she was suspect as a capitalist roader. It must sound better in Mandarin. In English, it sounds like your HO train building, capitalist roader. Her grandfather would join the party very early days. Her mom and dad were both members of the party. Her great-grandfather died, I believe, in the Great Leap Forward, in the famine of 58 to 61 that continued into the 1960s. So there was reason to believe that her thoughts were reinforced by her whole family. And yet there's a scene that you give us through her eyes. It is the 31st of August. She and 12 of her classmates, wearing red armbands and wearing their drab clothes, blue and gray, I think. They change out of the clothes that they had, because these are children of the elite. They travel to Shanghai, and while her colleagues, the other classmates, are away distributing leaflets, she sees a man crawling on the ground. What did she see? What does she remember, Tanya?
And so as she sees this man bleeding on the ground, she realizes as she looks that there is an entire baseball court full of corpses, a whole number of people who have clearly been beaten to death by Red Guards. And what was most striking, perhaps, was that even speaking about that all those decades later, it was clearly something that was profoundly traumatic and very real for her, even in that moment. It really didn't feel like a memory in the sense of something one discusses, but something that was very immediate and visceral, and still immensely disturbing to her all these years on.
You present the scene this way as an amateur reader. You're in a Starbucks or a coffee shop in some fashion in Beijing, and she's very soft-spoken, remembering her childhood. And yet at this moment, her voice becomes sharp, very loud, so that people can overhear. Is that the way you experienced it?
Yes, yeah.
And was she aware of this?
No, I don't think she was. As I said, it felt very much to me that she really wasn't with me at that moment, in a sense. It was as if she was back in 1966. She was back in that immensely distressing and traumatizing moment. And it seemed to me that that memory was something that remained very real and very present and very immediate to her.
And yet there are ironies here. She also talks about riding the trains for free. So many Red Guards' children were in the land with their red armbands smashing and stealing and plundering and accusing, that the Chinese economy ground to a halt. The train system was halted. And yet her memory is they were traveling for free back and forth across the country. This is an enormous country, from Chongqing, and there was one point where the train stopped, and I didn't recognize why it was attracted to them to get out, but they did, and she was very happy. Where were they? Do you recall the place in China?
They were in a very famous Chinese beauty spot, a very well-known scenic spot. And so they simply decided to leap off the train. I mean, this is one of the very strange things, I think, for us to try to understand about the Cultural Revolution, that for many people, for all the unquestionable horror and for all the many people who are deeply traumatized by it, there were also a large number of people who remember the Cultural Revolution very fondly. And part of that is perhaps a nostalgia reflecting their concerns about the modern day, a feeling that the modern day is materialistic or too empty of meaning and belief. And they see it as a sort of purer, more egalitarian time when everybody believed in something. But it is also about the fact that for many people, it was freeing. You weren't going to lessons anymore. You might be hanging around on a street corner with your friends and enjoying this sort of break from discipline. Or you might be feeling that you were on a great mission to spread the word of revolution, traveling around the country. And suddenly you went from being in this very tightly locked down society as a child in a system where there was great hierarchy to suddenly being on top of the world, in a sense, and being in a position of some authority and immense freedom. It's perhaps not surprising, even as strange as it seems to us, perhaps it's not surprising that it was quite intoxicating for some young people. Even people who had profound doubts, such as Yu Xiangzhen, nonetheless acknowledge that at the time there was also a certain excitement there.
The book is Red Memory. Tanya Bronigan is the author. We've been speaking of the elite children. We're going to turn to a man, a child from peasantry, and his memory of these periods. I'm John Batch.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.